The U.S. Catholic bishops from Region 3, comprising New Jersey and Pennsylvania, are in Rome this week for their Ad Limina visits. Their visit follows closely on the fall plenary of the Bishops' Conference, in which religious liberty and the role of religion in public life was very much in focus. Chris Altieri asked the group's senior prelate, Archbishop John J. Myers of Newark, New Jersey, about the issue. Their conversation started, however, with a broad overview of the life of the church in Newark.
In fact, it is a vibrant church, and it's one of the larger dioceses in the country. We report 1.3 million Catholics in just in the four counties, which are the Archdiocese of Newark. But we have over 600,000, of which we are aware of, Spanish-speaking, and we have 20 other ethnic groups represented. So some of those, for reasons of their own, don't identify themselves by registering at a parish and that sort of thing. So the number is not cast in stone, but in fact we have a lot of vocations. We are not one of those dioceses which can't function because or assign priests because we lack priests. We have a good number of priests, and we cooperate well with the New Jersey Catholic Conference. We came out, the bishops of the state came out recently with a statement on poverty and not forcing the poor to bear the burden of rectifying the economy in the United States. But in fact, we respect the people and the priests. We have Seton Hall University, which is owned by the Archdiocese. We have three seminaries, but all of the men take their both philosophy and theology at Seton Hall University, at the faculty there. And in general, it's thriving. We face the same kinds of strains and stresses that I think most urban dioceses, especially in the East, faced, that while our population has remained stable, it is not growing because, as probably you are aware, many people are moving to the South and to the West, and that has an effect on us. We're trying to maintain which is a very good school system. We have, I believe, 83 elementary schools, and when the federal program announced blue ribbon schools earlier in the fall, there were 17 in the state of New Jersey, and seven of them were the grade schools of the Archdiocese of Newark. So I think that all in all, we are doing well. We're thriving. We have to always consider where the people are and taking that into account when we make decisions about parishes and schools and that sort of thing. But we do that in a very participative way. So I think that's one of the strengths of the Archdiocese, that we don't just legislate from the mountaintop, that we involve priests and people in the decision-making process.
You also mentioned something that really piqued my interest was the diversity, the ethnic diversity of the Catholic population of the diocese. It's almost like a microcosm of the church in the United States, which has this fascinatingly rich texture to it. How is the multi-ethnic makeup of American society influencing the church in the States?
Well, we have Mass in 21 different languages every weekend. We've been able to have some of our own priests study languages. We have some priests that we've invited in from other countries. So if their language is more difficult or if we don't have someone who can learn that language. But we go from Korean parishes to Haitian parishes to Polish parishes, and we could just keep naming. Nigerian parishes, we could just keep naming the nationalities whom we have present, and we try to be genuinely welcoming. We do that helping them as we can by keeping the schools open, even at some cost to ourselves, although that is going to eventually have to be considered. Also, we work very hard to make sure that the young people can have catechetics and that we have Mass available for them at a reasonably close church building. So we really try to be welcoming and accommodating to the degree that we can. But it is a challenge, and especially if you come from central Illinois, it's a particular challenge to learn about all of this. And I'm not especially a linguist, so I don't know all these languages.
It must be difficult to go and have the various and sundry things that a bishop has to do with church dedications and confirmations and everything in so many languages. It's mind-boggling.
Well, first of all, I have 4 active auxiliaries and 3 retired auxiliaries. And we also have a retired archbishop who is the oldest bishop in the United States, Archbishop Peter Garrity, who will be 100 years old next July. I don't try to do everything myself. I have assigned coordinators for the various language apostolates and priest coordinators and occasionally permanent deacon or a layperson as a coordinator of different kinds of programs. And so we work together. I don't think that I have all the skills or all the knowledge in the world. And coming into a diocese as large and complex as Newark, it would be foolish of me to pretend that I have all the answers. I don't. We work together to work things out.
One of the things that you were touching on just now, talking about how we're trying to be accommodating, it's an essential part of the church's mission, welcoming the stranger. But that doesn't mean that there aren't legitimate concerns on the other side for security, for good order, et cetera. The one question I would have is, how is the church thinking about managing that tension? And that leads me to wonder more broadly and generally, how does the church understand her role and the role of religion in general in public life? Because the United States right now, as the American people, a deeply religious people, but we're going through one of our periodic reflections, public thinking, as it were, about this question.
We are of the opinion, and the bishops at our meeting in November a few weeks ago discussed the matter. We do think that their society itself, as well as the certain governments, both national and state, are making a mistake in the way they understand religious freedom. There seems to be an attack on it, especially not only religious freedom, but freedom of religious practice. And we are quite concerned that some programs in some situations will try to establish criteria which the church, because of our deeply held faith convictions, cannot go along with. We can't put them into practice. And I think an underlying mistake is the thought that that religion and religious practice are a private matter, and they really should not cross over into affect one's voting or one's personal opinions about public matters. And we think that is a fundamental error, that one cannot divide oneself in half, half devoted to matters of the faith and half devoted to public affairs and the public discussion. And so the American bishops, you will find, are increasingly in the next years will be articulating this point of view.
In fact, you've asked Bishop Laurie to head up the committee.
Bishop Laurie is a dear friend of mine. He's from Connecticut. And he gave a wonderful presentation at our meeting in Baltimore in November. He is articulating the themes that we will learn to articulate more clearly with the hope of convincing people that from the beginning, the founders of the nation expected people to have religion, and most of them, and not all of them, but most of them would refer to God and matters religious in their own statements.
You're talking about learning how to articulate this, and this is an important element in the whole discussion because along with the right to engage and speak in the public square and to express opinions and to persuade and to be fully involved as responsible active participants, right. Catholics and the Church herself, doesn't she have a responsibility when she engages in the public square to explain herself in terms that would at least be found reasonable by any interlocutor? And balancing that tension between saying, you know, as Catholics, we believe that life begins at conception, for example, which is quite true, and we do, and it does, but we don't know this necessarily through the faith. Reason can arrive at this, right?
Well, that's the whole point. First of all, a good teacher always learns what the questions are that people come to him or her with. And that's part of our learning, to know what the questions are that people have so that we can address them more clearly. In some matter, and life issues would be one of those, we believe that it is clear not simply from the scriptures, but from sound human reason that life is sacred. We are made in the image of God, and that is fraught with good consequences primarily, and that a society which attacks that fact of existence is harming itself as well as harming people.
What would you say then to the more radical, if you will, secularist in our national conversation, people who look on the Church and don't see it as either a positive good or even something neutral, but as the Church and religion in general as a threat to liberty?
That's not something that one person can answer alone, and it's not something that one can answer simply with words. I think what we have to be able to do is first of all, know where they're coming from, but especially we have to live what we believe. We have to be credible in our faith, and then teach from there, teach from that point of view, so that our lives become our teaching. I think it was St. Francis who said, preach always, sometimes use words.
The presence of the Church in society through her corporal works of mercy especially is very often surprising, you know, in conversations that I'll have with people who say, well, you know, if the Church would just stop condemning people and start doing things, you know, and I say, but do you really have any idea how much the Church quietly does? And they don't. Part of that is because doing it quietly and diligently is part of Jesus' way. But in a PR-driven society, that creates issues. Right now, in the United States, there are many people who are not known for being Chicken Little who are quite concerned over the ability of the Church, starting in the very near future with the implementation of some new federal regulations, to conduct her corporal works of mercy, especially as regards medical care, the direct care that we offer, but across the board. What are we doing about that?
Well, that's precisely the kind of thing about which I was speaking. All of these initiatives taken together seem to be limiting not only our own freedom of practice of religion and living out our faith, but also other religions face the same kind of pressure and same kind of dilemma. And we intend to address that fact and to teach not only our very loyal Catholic people, but people in general. We need to address the society in general because these things have become a societal problem. And we can't simply change it by talking to Catholics, but we have to be talking more broadly.
It's one of those things that always surprises me coming out of the Second Vatican Council.
Yes.
An energetic and proactive thrust to the church's mission?
I think that's a part of, first of all, Gaudium et Spes is really, that is the church in the modern world, is really not a negative document. Essentially, what it is trying to do is affirm the positive values in various situations in society and calling on the church to support and be part of that. I think also related to that is the growth of the apostolate of the laity, so that it isn't the fact that we bishops sit back and issue all the answers, but that we try to proclaim the gospel and proclaim Jesus Christ and his teaching, and laypersons have a genuine vocation to carry the gospel, call it new evangelization, if you will, into the various positions which they hold and into their families, into their neighborhoods, among their friends. And I think that the council itself was not negative, but it was very positive. It could come across that way, and perhaps is sometimes presented that way, which I think is unfortunate.